Chapter 79. That our bodies will rise again through Christ. It has been proved that Christ has delivered us from those things we have incurred through the sin of the first man, from whom we have contracted not only sin, but also death, the punishment of sin, according to the Apostle, by one man sin entered into this world, and by sin death. Consequently Christ delivered us from both, namely, sin and death. Wherefore the Apostle says, "For if by one man's offense death reigned through one, much more they who receive abundance of grace, and of the gift, and of justice, shall reign in life through one Jesus Christ." And in order to afford us a proof of both in himself, he chose both to die and to rise again. He chose to die, in order to free us from sin. Wherefore the Apostle says, "As it is appointed unto men once to die, so also Christ was offered once to exhaust the sins of many." He chose to rise again, in order to free us from death. Wherefore the Apostle says, "Christ is risen from the dead, the first fruits of them that sleep, for by a man came death, and by a man the resurrection of life." Accordingly, we obtain the effect of Christ's passion, as to the forgiveness of sin, for it has been already stated that the sacraments produce their effect through the efficacy of Christ's passion. But we shall obtain the effect of Christ's resurrection, by being delivered from death, at the end of the world, when by the power of Christ, we shall all rise again. Hence the Apostle says, "If Christ be preached, that he arose again from the dead, how do some among you say, that there is no resurrection from the dead? But if there be no resurrection of the dead, then Christ is not risen again. And if Christ be not risen again, then our preaching is vain, and your faith is also vain." Therefore it is of faith to believe in the future resurrection of the dead. There are some, however, who disbelieve in the future resurrection of the body. Such is the perversity of their mind that when, in the Scriptures, they read about the resurrection, they refer such statements to the spiritual resurrection of those who, through grace, arise from sin. This error is condemned by the Apostle: "Shun profane and vain babblings, for they grow much towards ungodliness, and their speech spreadeth like a canker. Of whom are Hymenaeus and Philus, who have erred from the truth, saying that the resurrection is past already, which could only refer to a spiritual resurrection." Therefore it is against faith to substitute a spiritual for a bodily resurrection. Moreover, it is evident from other passages in the Epistle to the Corinthians that, in this particular one quoted above, the Apostle is speaking of the resurrection of the body. Thus, after a few words he goes on to say, "It is sown a natural body, it shall rise a spiritual body," thus clearly indicating the body's resurrection. And then he adds, "This corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality." Now this corruptible and this mortal refer to the body. Therefore it is the body that will arise again. Further, our Lord foretold both resurrections. He said, "Amen, amen, I say unto you, that the hour cometh, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live." These words, seemingly, refer to the spiritual resurrection of souls, which was already beginning when people believed in Christ. But afterwards he referred to the resurrection of the body, when he said, "The hour cometh wherein all that are in the graves shall hear the voice of the Son of God." Since it is clear that they who are in the graves are not souls but bodies, therefore the resurrection of bodies is foretold here. It is also expressly foretold by Job, "I know that my Redeemer liveth, and in the last day I shall rise out of the earth, and I shall be clothed again with my skin, and in my flesh I shall see my God." Reason also supplies an evident proof of the resurrection, provided we bear in mind what has already been proved. Thus we have shown that the human soul is immortal, so that it survives the body after its separation from it. It is also manifest from what has been stated that the soul is united to the body naturally, since it is by its essence the form of the body. Wherefore it is unnatural for the soul to be without the body. Now nothing unnatural can last forever, and consequently the soul will not remain forever without the body. Therefore, since the soul is immortal, it must needs be reunited to the body, and this is to rise again. Hence the immortality of the soul would seem to demand the future resurrection of the body. Again, it has been proved that man's natural desire tends to happiness. Now ultimate happiness is the perfection of the happy one. Consequently whosoever lacks something for perfection is not yet perfectly happy, since his desire is not yet wholly at rest, and all imperfect things naturally seek to attain to perfection. Now the soul, when separated from the body, is, in a way, imperfect even as any part is when severed from its whole, and the soul is naturally part of human nature. Therefore man cannot obtain ultimate happiness, unless his soul be reunited to his body, and this is all the more true, seeing that as we have shown, man cannot reach ultimate happiness in this life. Again, it was proved above, that divine providence punishes evildoers and rewards those who do well. Now, in this life man, who is composed of soul and body, either sins or lives aright. Therefore reward or punishment is due to man in respect of his body and of his soul. But it is plain that in this life man cannot obtain the reward of ultimate felicity, as we have shown above. Moreover, in many cases sins are not punished in this life, nay more, for it is said, why then do the wicked live? Are they advanced and strengthened with riches? Therefore we must postulate a reunion of soul and body, in order that both in soul and body man may be rewarded or punished. Chapter 80. Objections against the resurrection. Belief in the resurrection encounters a certain number of objections. In nature, that which is destroyed does not return to existence, identically the same as before, just as the habit that one acquires after losing it is not identically the same habit as before. And for this reason the purpose of nature is, by means of generation, to preserve the species of that which is destroyed. Accordingly, since death deprives man of life, and the human body is resolved into the primary elements, it would seem impossible for the same identical man to come back to life. Again, a thing cannot be identically the same, if any of its essential principles be not identically the same, since the change of an essential principle always induces a change in a thing's essence, whereby a thing is, and is one. Now, when a thing is utterly annihilated, it cannot resume existence as identically the same thing. A new thing, indeed, will be created, but the same thing will not be restored. And seemingly death annihilates several of man's essential principles. In the first place, his corporeity and the form of the mixture of elements, since the body is evidently dissolved. Secondly, the sensitive and nutritive parts of the soul, which cannot exist without the organs of the body. In fact, there would seem to be nothing left of humanity, which is the form of all that remains after the soul has left the body. Therefore it would seem impossible for the same man to rise again. Moreover, it would seem that continuity is an essential condition of identity, not only in quantities and movements, but also in qualities and forms. Thus when a healthy person falls sick and is restored to health, the health which he recovers is not identically the same as his previous health. Now death clearly deprives man of being, since corruption is the change of being into non-being. Therefore it is impossible for man to recover the same identical being as he had before. Consequently he will not be the same man, because things that are identical have the same being. Moreover, if the same human body returns to life, it follows that whatsoever was in the body must be restored to it. But this leads to most unseemly consequences, as regards not only the hair on the head, and distributed about the body, and the nails, all of which clearly are frequently cut away, but also other parts of the body which are dissolved by the hidden action of natural heat. And if all these things were to be restored to man when he rises again, the result would be most unseemly. Therefore, apparently, man will not rise again after death. Further, there are to be found men who eat human flesh and nothing else, and men thus nourished have children. Consequently the same flesh will be in several men, but it cannot possibly rise again in several men. And yet the resurrection would surely not be universal and entire, if each one did not regain what he had before. Therefore it would seem impossible that men will rise again. Again, that which is common to all the individuals of one species would seem to be natural to that species. But the resurrection is not natural to man, because no natural agent is of sufficient power to cause the resurrection of all mankind. Therefore all mankind will not rise again. Further, if we are delivered by Christ from sin, and from death the result of sin, seemingly those alone are to be delivered from death by rising again, who have partaken of the mysteries of Christ, whereby they are delivered from sin. But this does not apply to all men. Therefore it would seem that not all men will rise again. Chapter 81. Solution of the foregoing objections. In order to solve these difficulties, we must observe that in fashioning human nature, God, as we have already stated, bestowed on the human body something in addition to that which was due to it by virtue of its natural principles. This was a kind of incorruptibility, the result of the body being so proportioned to its form, that as the soul's life is everlasting, so was it possible for the body, through the soul, to live forever. This incorruptibility, although it was not natural in relation to a natural principle, was nevertheless natural, so to say, in relation to the end, inasmuch as the matter was proportioned to its natural form, which is the end of matter. Accordingly, when the soul, against the order of its nature, turned away from God, the body was deprived of that God-given disposition which made it proportionate to the soul, and death was the result. If then we consider the state in which human nature was created, death is incidental to man through sin. But this accident was removed by Christ, who through the merits of his passion destroyed death by dying. We conclude then that the body is restored from death to life, by the same divine power that created the body incorruptible. Accordingly, we reply to the first objection thus: the power of nature falls short of the divine power, even as the power of the instrument falls short of that of the principal agent. Hence, although nature is unable to restore a dead body to life, this can be done by the power of God. The reason why nature cannot do this is that nature always works through a form, and that which has a form already exists. Wherefore a thing cannot generate itself, but it generates something else that is its like in species. And when it has been destroyed, it has lost its form, by which it could be a principle of action. Consequently, that which has been destroyed cannot be restored to its identity by the operation of nature. But the divine power, which brought things into being, so works through nature that, without it, it can produce an effect of nature, as we have proved above. Therefore, since the divine power changes not though things themselves be destroyed, it can restore integrity to things which have been corrupted. The second objection does not prove that the same man cannot rise again. None of man's essential principles is utterly annihilated by death, because the rational soul, which is man's form, remains after death, as we have shown. The matter also which was subject to that form remains under the same dimensions that individualized it. Accordingly, the same man will be restored as a result of the union of the same identical matter with the same identical form. As to corporeity, it can be taken in two ways. In one way, it signifies the substantial form of the body, considered as a substance, and thus the corporeity of any body whatever is its substantial form, whereby that thing belongs to such and such a genus and species, and owing to which a body has the three dimensions. For there are not, in one and the same thing, several substantial forms, by one of which it belongs to a supreme genus, substance for example, and by another, to its proximate genus, such as bodies or animals, and by yet another, to its species, such as man or horse. For, if the first form makes it a substance, the subsequent forms would be additions to that which is already an actual individual, subsisting in nature, so that they would not be constituents of that individual, but like accidental forms would be in the subject which is that individual. Consequently, corporeity, taken as meaning the substantial form in man, is nothing else but the rational soul, which requires the three dimensions in its matter, since it is the actuating principle of a body. In another sense, corporeity signifies an accidental form in regard to which a body is said to be in the genus of quantity, so that corporeity is identified with the three dimensions that enter into the definition of a body. Wherefore, although this corporeity returns to nothingness when the body is corrupted, this cannot prevent a man from being identically the same when he rises again, since corporeity, taken in the first sense, does not return into nothing, but remains the same. The form of a mixture can also be taken in two ways. In one way, it signifies the substantial form of a mixed body, and thus, since in man there is no other substantial form besides the rational soul, as we have proved, neither can it be said that the form of the mixture, considered as his substantial form, is annihilated when a man dies. In another way, when a number of simple qualities are mixed and attempered so as to form a composite quality, this latter may be called the form of the mixture, and stands in the same relation to the substantial form of the mixed body, as a simple quality does to the substantial form of a simple body. Wherefore, if the form of the mixture, thus understood, comes to nothing, This is no proof against the identity of the body that rises again. This same applies to the sensitive and nutritive parts of the soul. If by these we mean the sensitive and nutritive powers, which are natural properties of the soul or rather of the composite, they cease to be when the body ceases to be, and this does not interfere with the body's identity in the resurrection. If, however, by these parts we mean the very substance of the sensitive and nutritive soul, each of these is identical with the rational soul, for man has not three souls, but one only, as we have proved. As to the humanity, we must not imagine this to be a form resulting from the union of the form with the matter, and distinct from both, because, since the form makes the matter to be something actually to de anima, text 8, this additional form would not be substantial, but accidental. There are some who say that the form of the part is also the form of the whole, but that it is said to be the form of the part, inasmuch as it actuates the matter, and the form of the whole, inasmuch as it completes the species. Thus humanity is really nothing else but the rational soul, so that clearly it is not annihilated when the body is destroyed. But, seeing that humanity is the essence of man, and that the essence of a thing is indicated by the definition, and that the definition of natural thing indicates not the form only, but the form and the matter, it follows that humanity signifies something composed of matter and form, just as man does, but not in the same way. Humanity signifies the essential principles of the species, both formal and material, with abstraction of the individualizing principles, for humanity is that by which someone is a man, whereas it is not by the principles of individuality, but only by the essential principles of the species, that someone is a man. Wherefore humanity signifies nothing else besides the essential principles of the species, so that its signification is only partial. On the other hand, man signifies the essential principles of the species, without excluding the principles of individuality from its signification, since man signifies one having humanity, and this does not exclude his having other things. Wherefore its signification is complete, because it signifies the essential principles of the species actually, and the individualizing principles potentially. But Socrates signifies both actually, even as the genus includes the difference potentially, whereas the species includes it actually. From this it follows that both the very same man and the very same humanity rise again, by reason of the survival of the rational soul, and the unity of matter. The third objection in stating that identity of being depends on continuity, is based on the false premise. For it is evident that matter and form have one being, since matter has not actual being except through a form. In this respect, however, the rational soul differs from other forms, because the being of other forms is nothing else but their adherence to matter, for they do not transcend matter, either in being or in operation, whereas it is clear that the rational soul transcends matter in operation, since by its operation of understanding it is independent of any bodily organ, and consequently, its being is not merely adherence to matter. Therefore the soul's being, which was that of the composite, remains after the dissolution of the body, and when the body is restored at the resurrection, it receives again the same being, which has remained in the soul. The fourth objection proves nothing against the identity of those who rise again. That which is not an obstacle to man's identity in this life, is clearly no obstacle to his identity when he rises again. Now, while a man lives, the parts of his body do not always remain the same as to matter, but only as to species. In fact, as regards matter, the parts come and go. Yet this does not prevent a man from retaining his identity from the beginning of his life to the end. Take fire for an example. As long as it continues to burn, we say that it is the same fire, because its species remains, and yet the logs have been consumed, and fresh ones have been put on. It is the same with the human body, since each single part retains its form and species during the whole of a lifetime, whereas their matter is both dissolved by the action of natural heat, and renewed by means of nourishment. Now a man remains the very same man, as to his various parts and stages of life, although the matter of his body changes from one stage to another. Accordingly, for a man to rise again identically the same as before, there is no need that he should have restored to him all the matter that was in him during his whole lifetime, but only as much as would suffice for the quantity due to him, and especially such matter as is closely connected with form and species. If there be anything lacking to a man's proper quantity, whether because he died before reaching maturity, or because he has lost a limb, The divine power will supply the deficiency, nor will this prevent the identity of the rising body, seeing that nature too makes additions to a child's body from extraneous sources, so that the body attains to maturity, and such an addition does not change its identity, since the child and the adult are the same man. Hence we gather that even if some people partake of human flesh, this is no proof against identity in the resurrection, as the fifth objection argued. In fact, as we have already proved, there is no need that whatever was in man materially should rise again in him, and that if anything be lacking, it can be supplied by God's power. Accordingly, the flesh consumed will rise again in the man in whom it was first perfected by a rational soul. The second man, if he partook of other food besides human flesh, will rise again with only such matter as he acquired from this other food, and in such quantity as is required for the proper size of his body. But if he partake of no other food, he will rise again with what he received from his parents, and the deficiency will be supplied by the omnipotence of his Creator. And if his parents also partook of none but human meat, so that this seed would also be engendered therefrom, their children will rise again with that seed, and he whose flesh was consumed will be supplied from another source. In the resurrection it will be the rule that if any matter belong to several in common, it will rise again in him to whose perfection it most intimately belonged, so that if it were in one as the radical seed from which he was generated, and in another as the result of nourishment, it will rise again in the man who was generated from it as from seed. But if it were in one as belonging to the perfection of the individual, and in another as directed to the perfection of the species, it will rise again in him to whom it belonged as a perfection of the individual. Hence the seed will rise again in the begotten and not in the begetter, and Adam's rib will rise again in Eve, and not in Adam, in whom it was as in the principle of nature. And if it be in both on the same count, it will rise again in the one to whom it first belonged. The reply to the sixth objection is clear from what we have already said. Resurrection is natural, if we look at its final cause, inasmuch as it is natural for the soul to be united to the body, but its efficient cause is not natural, since it is caused by the power of God alone. Nor should we deny that all will rise again, although all men do not believe in Christ, nor are partakers in his mysteries. The Son of God took human nature that he might restore it. Accordingly, the natural defect that is shared by all will be repaired, and the dead will rise again. But this defect will not be repaired perfectly, save in those who adhere to Christ, either by their own action in believing in him, or at least by the sacrament of faith. Chapter 82. That man will rise again immortal. It follows that man will so rise as not to die again. The necessity of dying is a defect that nature has contracted from sin. Now Christ, by the merits of his passion, repaired the defects which nature contracted from sin, for as the apostle says, not as the offense, so also the gift. For if by the offense of one many died, much more the grace of God, and the gift, by the grace of one man Jesus Christ, have abounded unto many. From this we gather that Christ's merit is more efficacious in destroying death, than Adam's sin in causing it. Therefore those who rise again, being delivered from death by the merits of Christ, will not die again. Further, that which is to endure forever has not been destroyed. Wherefore, if after rising from the dead men are to die again, so that death will go on forever, death was in no sense destroyed by the death of Christ. Yet it has been destroyed now indeed in its cause, as the Lord foretold by the prophet Hosea, "O death, I will be thy death," and at last it will be actually destroyed, according to 1 Corinthians 15:26. "And the enemy death shall be destroyed last." It is therefore part of the church's faith that those who arise will not die again. Moreover, the effect is likened to its cause. Now Christ's resurrection is the cause of the resurrection to come, as stated above. But Christ so rose from the dead that he will not die again, according to Romans 6, 9, Christ rising from the dead, dieth now no more. Therefore men will so rise, that they will die no more again. If after rising from the dead men are to die again, either they will rise again from this latter death, or they will not. If not, their souls will remain forever separated from their bodies, and we have proved this to be unfitting, and for this reason it is granted that they will rise again. Otherwise, if they were not to rise again after dying a second time, there would be no reason for their rising after dying the first time. On the other hand, If they rise again after this second death, either this second resurrection will be followed by yet another death, or not. If not, the same argument applies as to their first resurrection. And if they are to die again, there will be an indefinite alternation of death and life in the subject. But this is unseemly, because God must have some definite end in raising the dead to life, while alternate death and life is a kind of succession and change which cannot be an end, for movement of its very nature cannot be an end, since all movement tends towards something else. Further, the purpose of nature's action in this lower world tends to perpetuity, because that action is directed to generation, which aims at the perpetuation of the species. Hence nature does not intend this or that individual as its last end, but the preservation of the species in the individual. It is thus with nature, because nature acts by the power of God, the fount of perpetuity. Wherefore the philosopher says that the purpose of generation is that the participation of the divine being may be perpetuated in the things generated. Much more therefore does the action of God himself tend to something perpetual. Now resurrection is not directed to the perpetuity of the species, since this might have been secured by generation. Therefore it is directed to the perpetuation of the individual, but not in respect of the soul only, for the soul has this without the resurrection. Therefore, in respect of the composite, and consequently man, will live forever after the resurrection. Again, if we compare the soul and body from the point of view of a man's first generation on the one hand and of his resurrection on the other, we shall find a different order between them. In man's first generation, the creation of the soul follows the generation of the body, for at first the matter is prepared by the power of the disconnected seed, and then God creates and infuses the soul, whereas in the resurrection the body will be united to the pre-existing soul. Now the first life, which man obtains by generation, follows the condition of the mortal body, in that death puts an end to it. Therefore the life which he obtains by the resurrection will be everlasting, in accordance with the condition of the immortal soul. Again, if there be an indefinite succession of life and death in the same man, this alternating life and death will form a kind of circle. Now, in things subject to generation and corruption, every circle originates from the first circle of incorruptible bodies, for the first circle is composed of local movement, and this is communicated thence by way of imitation to other kinds of movement. Consequently, the alternation of death and life would be caused by a heavenly body, but this is impossible, since the restoration of life to a dead body is beyond the scope of nature's action. Hence we cannot admit this alternation of death and life, nor consequently that bodies will die after rising from the dead. Further, whatsoever things succeed one another in the same subject, last for a certain time, and all such things are subject to the heavens' movement, of which time is a result. But the separated soul is not subject to the movement of the heavens, because it is above all corporeal nature. Consequently, its alternate separation from and union with the body is not subject to the heaven's movement. Therefore, there is no such rotation of alternate death and life as would result if those who rise from death were to die again. Therefore they will rise to die no more. Hence it is said, the Lord shall cast death down headlong forever, and death shall be no more. Hereby we reject the error of certain heathens of old, who held that the history of times and temporal things repeats itself. For instance, just as once upon a time the philosopher Plato taught at Athens in the school known as the Academy, so during a space of countless previous centuries, at long but certain intervals, we shall find again and again the same Plato, and the same city, and the same disciples, and we shall go on finding them during ages without number. So Augustine relates to this, says he, some would refer the words of Ecclesiastes 9:10, what is it that hath been? The same thing that shall be. What is it that hath been done? The same that shall be done. Nothing under the sun is new, neither is any man able to say, behold, this is new, for it had already gone before it in the ages that were before us. This, however, does not mean that the same identical things occur over again, but the same kind of thing, as Augustine explains. Aristotle also taught this in opposition to the foregoing view.